Well, we've thought of communicating the good news through festivals, through Muslim festivals, and through Christian festivals. But I haven't come on yet to the matter of communicating the gospel through rites, or through rites of passage, as some people would call them. What happens at a birth? What happens at a marriage? What happens at a funeral? And Muslims are very interested in not so much in what Muslims, what Christians believe, but often in what they do. And so what we do can be a very significant way of sharing good news. Let me give you an example. I was doing some Bible study helping this young man with his Bible study because he was enrolled in the Christian Bible correspondence course, which was operating from another city, and his Bible correspondence courses came through the mail. And the postmaster started interfering with his mail because he didn't approve of this type of mail. And so this young man came to ask me, was there any other way of arranging things? So I said I thought I could find a way of arranging things, but it would take some time. And I thought I could see he was very keen about studying. So I said, well, maybe I could give you some to keep up. I've got something here. It's kind of correspondence. It's question and answer. So if you'd like to do this, then you can bring it to me and I'll check it for you. I will check your answers and so on. I thought he'd come about once a week, but he came about every other day. He really wanted to learn. We got things sorted out eventually. But there was a very bad accident during that period, and four of my friends were killed in a car accident, and Christians. And he came very quickly when this accident occurred. He thought maybe I was involved in the accident, so he came to find out if I was okay, and I was okay. I hadn't been involved in the accident. But then he said, how do Christians... what do you do for a funeral? And what do you do? So he wanted to know. So I told him, I gave him quite a lot of things about what took place. He wanted to know quite a lot of detail. And then having explained the rite or the detail to an extent, I could then talk to him about the belief behind it. So I got out my prayer book, Anglican prayer book, because it tells you a bit more it's a sort of more formal statement about what you do and what you say. So I think that I felt was appropriate. He would sort of line up with that a bit. Don't get out my prayer book with everybody, but so we looked at 1 Corinthians 15. And the meaning, the whole thought about Christ's death and so on. Interestingly, this man eventually, through some lot of difficulty in many ways, he became a believer. He was like a flower opening up to anything he heard. And when I came to Cyprus, I was in touch with him. When I visited Pakistan after I'd left, retired from there, he came 300 miles from, or it's more than that, from the frontier to the Punjab to see me in Lahore. So I took the chance to take him round and introduce him at the Christian to various Christian institutions and meet Christian leaders and so on. But when my mother died a few years ago, he wrote to me. And I think that his letter perhaps was the most lovely letter that I received. And he talked about her being in heaven and so on. I have to say that the letter that touched me most was from this young man who, for Christ's sake, has faced many difficulties and who is living in a village, well, his ancestral village. He can't be baptized there. He isn't baptized, actually. And he's already faced... quite a considerable amount of persecution. He's very, very keen for the education of his two daughters, and he's a writer, journalist, and he's a teacher as well, and he's obviously writing to, he wrote to me, women are treated like cattle, and he was furious. I mean, he's really got a concern about children, women and children, and he's got two daughters, and he's negotiating to be able to enroll them in the Christian school in this town. But at the moment he's working in Saudi Arabia, and no one else is interested in getting his kids from the 3 miles from the village to this school, though it wouldn't be a cost or anything. So until he gets back there, he can't work it out. They're about 5 and 6, these kids. But the loveliest of letters from a brother in Christ, very, very clear about his understanding of death and resurrection, of Jesus, who is the resurrection and the life. Now, I think you've read The Death and Burial of a Muslim. You had this for reading, and you read it first. I'd just like one or two responses about how it struck you. Yeah, quickly.
Extremely detail-oriented.
Extremely detailed. What was extremely detailed?
Everything they do about wrapping the corpse, and even when they die, and where they should be facing, and all kinds of things. Very, very detailed.
Yeah. Extreme detail, yes. How else did it strike you, Anita?
Also with corresponding prayers or recitations that went with each.
Yes. The prayers that go alongside all these detailed actions and the way to wrap the body, what side, who should do it, the measurements of the sheeting and the calico and requirements for male and female kafan. It's the shroud, I suppose. Sheeting, 4 meters, 140 meters, centimeters, sorry, 150 centimeters or 180 centimeters wide, according to the size of the body. And then there's different sizes for men and women, and women have an extra garment. All this tremendous detail tells you what to do when someone's died, what to do after a person has passed away. Inform relatives and friends, prepare qabr, that's the tomb, that's the grave, arrange transport to the qabristan, which is the cemetery, if it's at a distance, perform the ghusl, that's the ritual washing of the body, put on the kafan. This is the shroud. Obtain doctor's certificate, obtain death certificate, and obtain burial order. So these things have to be done, and they have to be done within 24 hours. Ideally, if that person died, say, in the morning, they should be buried before sunset. And very often people are not, would be buried within 24 hours. It's a custom, but it's generally expected, and it mentions that should be how it should be. Christians also follow that. In a hot country, it's difficult to keep a corpse, and I have in the Punjab once we had a corpse under our fan. No fan here, but and with ice blocks to keep the body a bit longer, because the relatives were coming from the furthest parts of the country and they weren't quite sure. They wanted to postpone the burial, so that was our neighbourly duty to keep the corpse in our sitting room in the coolest place under the fan with lots of ice blocks around. So it's not unusual, but here it's written that it should be. Anything else that struck you?
I just found peculiar that they were real detail as far as who was going to touch the body, as far as the male should be washed by particular member of the family, son, yes, or his brother, and the females, and they're very, very particular and very detailed about that. And
yes.
Even the massaging of the stomach, it was just so many different things
that
they believe in doing.
Yeah, and then plugging of the sort of, what do you call
it? Open ears.
Yes, that's right. And all this, tremendous detail, right. So any question you want to ask about that? I got this in South India, this Lanesia. I don't remember where that was, but when I've been several times to South India, and I picked this up in a mosque. Then this second article that you read, I meant to put it in the list of magazines that you could read. This magazine's not in the library here, but I hope it will be, and I'm going to mention it. It's called The Bulletin, and it's the bulletin of the Henry Martin Institute of Islamic Studies. The Henry Martin Institute is now located in Hyderabad in India, and it's named after Henry Martin, who was a chaplain with the East India Company, who had a missionary heart, and he worked also among local people, Indians, and was very concerned, especially for Muslims. And he helped in the translation. In fact, he translated the Bible, the New Testament, and parts of the prayer book into Urdu. And also he was engaged in translation into Arabic and into Persian. He went to Shiraz. He used to debate with the leaders there. He died at the age of 33. Amazing person who enjoyed dictionaries so much and spoke languages very fluently and well, and is well known. So this institute is named after that. I get this bulletin. This is July to December 1995. So this article comes in that issue, and then in the same issue there's Contemporary Understanding of Human Rights in Islam, an article on that. And then there's an article on Traditional and Islamic Social Welfare Systems in Northwest Pakistan. That's where I lived. And then there's one on public and public qawwali, that's singing of these songs which are often sung at shrines. Then book reviews. But it's an Indian slant. It's a very useful magazine, and I'm going to recommend that it be added to the magazines that are used here in the library. So how did this strike you? This Contemporary Death Rites and Funeral Customs Among South Indian Muslims. I'm sure you understood why I wanted you to read the other one first. But so any comments on this article? Yes?
It seems like they did a great deal of different things as a means of an assurance of their salvation. For example, I guess they perfumed the body or painted across the body, so to speak. They put, I'm trying to think of the exact words, but the creed,
yes,
basically, and then they would say it, and then 40 steps later they would pray for the person.
Yes.
Just seemed so...
Yeah. See, there's a lack of assurance in the salvation in Islam, a lack of assurance. It's presumptuous to think that God has forgiven you. So no Muslim, probably no Muslim, would say, I'm sure that my sins are forgiven. So you see this, it's, as you say, coming up in this kind of rites and the prayers as the cortege goes to the graveyard and so on. And this is partly why I say it's a good idea to present the good news as a release from the bondage of death and of sin. A Muslim doesn't have problems with the idea of being liberated or released. Jesus said he'd come to release the captives of fear, of sin, and so on. So if you tell a Muslim, I'm released from my sins, I'm delivered from the bondage of drug taking or whatever bondage I like to mention. And whatever, I wouldn't mention that because I haven't had that bondage, but I have other bondages. So it's okay to say I am sure that my sins are forgiven through Christ, but then the Muslim will think this is presumption and think I'm presumptuous. It won't mean that I will never say that, but if you can, it's the gospel can be presented in different ways, and if we're going to stress, let's stress the deliverance and the breaking of the bonds, and let us stress that side of it more than the assurance, because a Muslim will not see assurance as a wonderful offer. A Muslim will see you as a presumptuous person. Anything else that struck you?
I felt this was more of a practical paper than the other was law.
Yes.
Do this, do that. This, like, what are the women doing while the men are off at the funeral?
Yes.
And what do you eat? And so yeah. I just felt like it was a much more, like, right. I like this one much better.
Yes, of course. Yeah. I think we all did. Yeah. And the women, there's no special job for women when the men are taking the corpse for burial, but they would be preparing food. They have this very good habit of, or custom of, the bereaved don't have to do any cooking for some days. People will bring to their home, so because they're involved in, everybody comes to say how sorry they are about what's happened and so on and so forth, they don't have time for cooking. And they don't have time to prepare meals for the people who come to their home. Sometimes Christians emulate Muslims. I remember going to a 40th day celebration, not celebration, commemoration for Christian. I've been been often to these things. And it's part of the third day and 40th day commemoration, which you read about in this article, remembering the dead. Now, and praying for the dead too. So a Christian once invited me, because some relative of hers had died, and this was 40 days afterwards, and I was asked to pray. They said, please will you, they said, pray for the dead. So I thought, that's a good test. So I got up and I said, well, I don't actually pray for the dead, I pray for the living. So I'm going to pray for everyone. I'm praying for this home and I'm praying for the living. And so I went ahead and prayed for the living because I don't feel it was a Christian home, supposedly. And I'm on Christian territory, so to speak. So I didn't think if I were in a Muslim home, I've been asked to pray in Muslim homes, I would probably not give a statement. I would just pray and I wouldn't. I would find some way to give thanks and so on, but I wouldn't pray for the dead. Well, I want to use the last few minutes to refer to an article which I found interesting. It's in a book called The Islamic Understanding of Death and Resurrection. It's by two well-known women, Jane Smith, who's an Islamicist, and Yvonne Haddad, who's a university professor, and well, she was in Ann Arbor, I think. Not sure where she is now. But I was particularly interested. I haven't read the whole book, but I read one of the appendices. It's B, and it's on the subject of Appendix B, the special case of women and children in the afterlife. And I thought that must be very interesting, so I just went through it. And I'll just share a few thoughts here from it. You might want to read it yourself, or I think it's quite useful to consider what Muslims are thinking. And you're working with Muslim women. Well, what are they going to look forward to in the afterlife? What do they think they're looking forward to? And what does the Quran and the Hadith and the community say they're going to look forward to? And what about children? So I just quote a few things. Women in the afterlife. The occasional conclusion of observers of Islam, particularly in the early stages of Christian missionary outreach to the Muslim community, has been that women, according to the Islamic understanding, do not have souls. Someone brought this up the other day. And then the writer here, Yvonne Haddad, says this is totally incorrect. And I think it's totally incorrect. If this were true, it would have grave and obvious implications for the issue of judgment and responsibility in regard to women. Now, the Quran is very clear that every soul must bear his own responsibility and his own sin. So every woman must bear the responsibility for her own life and for her own sin. And if women don't have souls, it's an undermining, in a way, of this issue of judgment and responsibility, which the Quran so greatly stresses. Incidentally, it's one of the reasons that Muslims find it difficult to accept the idea that Christ bore our sins because of this doctrine. Anyway, it's not Quranic and it's not in the Hadith, and it's not correct to say that Muslims... I don't know how this got started. I think it's, she may explain it in one of her footnotes. I haven't read the footnotes yet. So it's not to be accepted. And she says too, while certain of the Hadiths have greatly elaborated the suggested fate of women after death from the Quranic intention, it is equivocally clear in the Quran itself that men and women are on an equal footing when it comes to the chances of final felicity or perdition. So that's a clear statement. She also goes into what, not just what is written in the Hadith and what is written in the Quran, but what modern writers in Islam are now saying. She says modern writers and commentators generally concur that the wives are not to be punished for the deeds of their husbands, although one does find an occasional reference to the contrary. The Quran has little to say about earthly women in relation to eschatological concerns. So there's not much said. However, the Hadiths were certainly influential in moulding the opinions and understanding of many generations, many centuries of Muslims. While they do not necessarily reflect either the revelation of God or the teaching of the Prophet, they are nonetheless significant insofar as they reveal a cultural understanding important to the historical development of Islam. So some of the cultural things have become a kind of baggage, like we get cultural baggage sometimes, or we do, in the Christian faith. We mix culture and our faith, and sometimes it's difficult to know which is which. And we have to be careful, especially if we go and work in another culture, that we are really communicating the gospel and its essentials, and we're not teaching people that they have to sit in pews and do everything the way we did it. I mean, that's just an extreme example, I suppose. But it's amazing how many churches in Pakistan have got pews, and it's completely uncultural. It's a hangover from the British Raj. People generally sit on the floor, or they sit on stools, and we don't have this Victorian architecture. The reversal of the natural order, so graphically portrayed in the Quran, is preceded in the transitional expansion of the series of eschatological events by other signs, signaling the disruption of ethical, moral, and social order. Let's give an example of that. Sounds rather complicated. But it has come to the state now that in some societies, women will go on pilgrimage with other women unaccompanied by a man. Now, that's not according to the book. It's not according to the Quran or to the traditions, but it is happening. And the number of males will decrease so that women... I don't understand what that one means. I don't think I'll quote that. Let me quote this. there's a statement, according to another version, the prophet related, this is what Muhammad is supposed to have said, I saw the fire, hell, and I have not seen to this day a more terrible sight. Most of the inhabitants are women. They, those to whom the prophet was talking, said, O messenger of God, why? He said, because of their ingratitude. They said, are they ungrateful to God? He said, no, but they are ungrateful to the companion, meaning husband, and ungrateful for the charity shown by their husbands to them. Even if you men continue to do good things for them, and a woman sees one bad thing from you, she will say, I never saw anything at all good from you. So it doesn't really help the image of the woman, does it? Other reports omit the direct reference to the fate of women in the fire, but indicate that women are deficient in their religious practice because of menstruation, which prevents them from fasting on certain times, suggesting punishment for a biological function, and that in many instances the husbands should be permitted the right to determine when and how their wives perform their religious duties. Okay, I'll leave that. There isn't really time at this point to explain so much, but let me conclude with a prayer that is used, and this gives us some clues. Prayers do give us clues. It's about the death of a child, and often we have opportunities to share with Muslim friends when a child has died. Death is an opportunity to give comfort, and we can certainly genuinely give comfort when a child dies, a baby, that it has gone to God who created it, or him or her. And we can say, I like to say that it is through Jesus that this child is accepted. And if I have a chance, I might in some try and be discreet and say, and through Jesus he would accept you, and you will meet up with your baby again. Anyway, here's the prayer. And the prayer recited in contemporary Egypt on the occasion of a child's death. You find in it a summary of the best Islamic thought concerning hope for the little one, as well as comfort for those who must face the ordeal of loss. O God, he is thy servant and the son of thy servant. Thou didst create him and sustain him and bring him to death, and thou wilt give him life. O God, make him for his parents an anticipation, riches sent on before, a reward which precedes, and through him make heavy the balance of their good deeds and increase their rewards. Let neither us nor them be seduced by temptation after his departure. O God, cause him to overtake the believers who preceded him in the guardianship of Abraham, and give him in exchange for his earthly home a better dwelling and a family better than his family, and keep him sound from the temptation of the tomb and from the fire of Gehenna. So it's good if you explore a bit what Muslims think about on women in the afterlife. I haven't gone into the question of hur, the huris and women, but they are not the same, believers and huris. We could go into that at some other time, but do use, consider prayerfully how you may use the opportunities with people who have been bereaved, and also see what Muslims do believe about women in the afterlife and children. It's not much.